to be honest, you know, now I'm 66 years old, and when someone says, hey, well, come on into town and we'll do this and run a half marathon and we'll just all live happily ever after. You know, I have to think about this because it's not so much the speed at this point, but self-preservation. And there's a certain orthopedics that's involved, and you want to make sure you can get through it, and you want to make sure you do it in a way that you can continue to run. So in a way, it's more difficult than when I was running twice as fast, if you want to put it that way. It's almost as if I have more trepidation about it than I did when I was initially doing it, because 38 years ago, 13 miles was about two-thirds of the amount of running I did on a daily basis, whereas it certainly isn't the amount of running I do now on a daily basis.
How much do you run?
I run 6 or 7 miles a day, and I run about 6 days a week. But then you have all the other things to consider as you get older, which in sports like running and in long distance running happens at the age of 35. That's usually, if you're drug free, that's when the decline begins to set in, and you have to adapt. And so for me, again, this is part of that process of, in a way, self-preservation, but also mentally, the way I look at it is, I am trying, since I was 35 years old, and that's almost half my lifetime ago, to slow down as slowly as I can, because I know I'm slowing down. And so that involves not only running every day, but being in a routine where I do a lot of weight training. I do a lot of other exercise to maintain my level of fitness.
So was there anything other than sort of emotionally or mentally preparing yourself to run a 13.1-mile course that you had to do?
I think it's you realize that the effort is actually harder. The speed is slower, but the effort's harder. And that's why it's so easy, in a way, for me to do this, acknowledging the effort that the people who are going to try to exceed that time are going to go through. I understand what they're doing. And I think that is something that in 1977, I really didn't quite appreciate. So I have a much greater appreciation for the effort people go through to run that far. And it is. It's truly a goal. And that's why you have to have registration this many months ahead, September 9th, to lead in, because people need to take that goal seriously. And they need to prepare for a long period of time. In other words, the training sessions that they have, they're actually some, I wouldn't call them clinics, but just sort of events and sort of stepping stones that exist. There's one in February, one in March, one in April, that people can, you know, Ortho Indy is sponsoring them. And I think it's a great thing, because what it does, it draws attention to the fact that you do have to be careful in these things. And the more prepared you are going in, the least likely you are to have any problems, and the easier it's going to be.
Well, what is it about this race that makes you want to return year after year and want to run on Tuesday?
This, in terms of running history, the Indy Mini, and now obviously with much more support, it's called the One America 500 Festival Mini Marathon, and which is all great, you know, and that's the whole point, because we never thought then that it would evolve to this point where running could be so inclusive in terms of demography. Who would have thought that how far out it sort of spread in the population as a whole? This was really one of the first races. It truly was. It was 1977, and it really was in 78 and 79 and 80 where everything sort of exploded. And it had to do, I think, with the running community here. Sam Bell down at Indiana, the coach there, was one of the iconic track and field coaches in the U.S. Another one was my coach at Yale, Bob Gegengack. There was a fellow named Peyton Jordan at Stanford. Jumbo Elliott at Villanova. He was part of that core group of people. And then the running, and so Indiana has a history of running, for example, and it still goes through today, because in Terre Haute at Indiana State, you have a cross-country course there that I think should just be the annual national championship cross-country course. There, and that isn't just built immediately. It's because there is a tradition at work, and I always come back to, and people are always surprised to find out that Richard Luger had a big part in this, because our first race started at the Memorial downtown and finished at the Yard of Bricks. And I'll never forget Richard Lugar being there as the mayor of Indianapolis at the time and supporting this back when it was not cachet. You know, there was no bandwagon on which to jump. And so, and to watch him after that go to the Senate and then in subsequent years, meeting him in Washington every now and then because he became part of the Washington running community. There was actually a club of senators, you know, who would run. And so it's all part of that history and coming back every year. The other great thing I like about coming back here, it is one of the easiest, if not easiest and most pleasant downtown core starting points from which you can very immediately get out basically in the boonies along the river. And so whenever I come here and I want to go out for a run, I go out the hotel door and within 3 minutes I'm down on the canal and I'm basically out of town.
Since you won the Olympic gold medal in 1972, there's been this evolution of long distance running from something that's sort of very elite and only a few people are ever destined to do it to being this thing that basically anyone can do. What accounts for that evolution?
I think a lot of it is emotional and biomechanical, and there's a connection. Because I think a lot of people use activity of many types as stress relief. We all do it. And I think many more people over time began to find out that that's their form of stress relief that suited them. Because I did the same thing when I was growing up and in college and then after college. But I was just good at it. And what I liked, and to get around to why the appeal, I think the distance became demystified. I think it got to where the body of knowledge got, as more and more people began to train, you realized that it really was more a question of commitment than genetic gift. And I liked it because the more inclusive it's become, the happier I am. One of the reasons I ran my first marathon was at the time there was a group of sort of what I call, even at that time, holdover hippies in Southern California who were running these marathons, and they did it because, you know, and you had to have a beard and you had to have a special personality and you had to be ascetic and give up everything and just make all these sacrifices. And I went, heck, I run 20 miles every Sunday. You know, I can do this.
There are a lot of people who would credit your win in 1972 with sort of igniting that enthusiasm for long distance running and sort of making it the phenomenon it became. What do you make of that? Do you think that's accurate?
I think I had a role, and I'm a firm believer now, especially after my involvement as chairman of US Anti-Doping when it started out, and to see how over the last 10 years or so that evolved to a point where no one ever thought it was going to be, where it actually had an impact on sport. No one ever planned it. And the enjoyable part of it has been that it wasn't something that came out of Madison Avenue. It wasn't a public relations platform that was developed. And it essentially at the start was individuals in certain areas. There was a group of runners who wanted to continue to run after their Olympic experience and didn't want to have to retire because there was no way to make a living. Then I think historically at the time, there was the first longitudinal study on exercise and health was actually coming out. Believe it or not, in the early 1970s, the Framingham study out of Boston, that was this Harvard study and ongoing of the connection between exercise and health. It was really the first scientific proof that exercise could actually benefit you. And then there was some research being done by certain physiologists and cardiologists that was really a new form of medical science. You know, physiology in the early 1970s was not exercise physiology. It was physiology studying sedentary people. Now every cardiologist worldwide who has any credibility has a treadmill in his or her office. Which before it was, why do you want to do this? You're going to hurt people, you know. And so I think it was all part of that. You know, society was ready. But I also think, you know, the fact that I was an American, I won the race in Munich. People watched it on ABC TV. Rune Arledge, who really changed sports television and Olympic telecast at the time, it just happened to be at that point where he decided in that telecast he was going to feature the marathon. And he didn't know I was going to win. So again, it's all those things coming together. But I think my role was, I just decided I was going to go back to law school after I won and then keep running, go back to another Olympics, which I did, and then take it from there. And I did. My career has basically been figuring out a way to earn my own living through the sport.
That's right. You went to law school, you passed the bar, and have you ever practiced law?
No, the only way I've used it is in the other ways I've tried to improve my sport. I came up with the idea that basically opened all amateur sport to prize money. And if that sounds like it's overstated, there's a fellow in town here named Olin Castle, who used to be the head of USA Track and Field, who, when I and my friends from Boulder went to him with a trust fund concept that I and one of my law partners had drawn up, he took this idea to the International Track Federation. It had to do with allowing runners to earn money, put it in their own individual trust, because the Olympic rules, as I had read them as a lawyer, in legal terms, I couldn't see any distinction between a federation in a country being able to take donations, make a trust, and then from that trust give the money to athletes. I said, why can't you have an individual trust? He, Olin Castle, took this to the International Track Federation. They approved it because they were looking for a solution to the Soviet bloc countries supporting their athletes and winning all the medals in the Olympics. And so we provided them with a solution. That's one way I've used my law degree. The other was when U.S. anti-doping was being formed in the late 1990s. I was contacted by Barry McCaffrey, who was President Clinton's drug czar at the time, and he was working on this issue. And I got involved in writing memoranda for him regarding what I saw would be an agency that actually worked, that wasn't set out to appear to be working. And don't get me going into how that is still the case with regard to the drug issue in professional sports. Appear to be working as long as the public is satisfied enough that you are. In private, you're not necessarily doing that. I worked with the Clinton White House. We got U.S. anti-doping established. I became the first chairman. And so I've used my law degree that way.